This episode is sponsored by Indeed. Building a great team is never easy. If you're a small business, hoping the right people see your job posting isn't the best growth strategy. When the pressure's on and you need the right hire, this is a job for sponsored jobs. Indeed Sponsored Jobs gets you quality candidates when you need them most. Because when you're hiring, you don't just want more applicants, you want the right applicants. Sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. That's because it helps you reach candidates that meet your specific criteria, such as skills, certifications, or location from the word go, boosting your job post in search results so you can reach the people that help your business thrive. So spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all of your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs. This episode is sponsored by Honda. Since its first Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix, Honda has always taken what's learned on the track and used it to build better cars for everyone. From pushing limits in F1 to engineering the next generation of hybrids like the Prelude Hybrid and Civic Sedan Hybrid, Honda proves that racing doesn't just inspire innovation, it drives it. And that idea of taking lessons from the racetrack and applying them to road cars has always been a part of Honda's DNA. Decades of engineering in the demanding world of Formula One have helped shape the performance and efficiency you see in Honda's road cars today. And now that same thinking is shaping the next generation of hybrids as well. Cars like the 2026 Prelude Hybrid and Civic Hybrid show that electrification can be both efficient and genuinely fun to drive. The 2026 Prelude Hybrid and Civic Sedan Hybrid are engineered for fun. From the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Prelude and Civic and the latest innovations at Honda.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to F1 Explains, the official Formula One podcast that is all about answering your questions on the greatest sport in the world. My name is Christian Hugill, and how this podcast works is you email F1explains@F1.com on any topic you like, so long as it is Formula One dependent. We insist on that much. And we find an expert from the world of Formula One to put your question to. And this week, our expert is, I can say this extremely comfortably, one of our most popular guests in F1 Explains history, someone who's been with us right from the start and someone who you always go absolutely mad for on this podcast, former Formula One strategist and part of the Sky Sports F1 television team, Bernie Collins. What a joy it is to have you here. Welcome back to F1 Explains.
Hey, thanks, Christian. Yeah, it's good to be back and good to be answering some of the questions, and that's a very kind introduction.
And it's entirely truthful, Bernie. It's entirely truthful. Bernie, we've got a bit of a mixed bag of questions today, sort of a bit of an F1 Explains quickfire episode. Of course, as I just mentioned, you were a strategist in Formula One. I say were because you used to work full-time within teams. I suppose once a strategist, always a strategist. You're still a strategist, but just for the television rather than for permanently sat wearing green in the case of your last job on the pit wall. So, of course, whenever you're on the pod, there tends to be strategy-themed questions. So shall we start with, as is tradition, a strategy-themed question?
Let's go.
Well, we should talk about the new season, Bernie, and, of course, the new era of Formula One we find ourselves in, where so many things, of course, have changed. How has strategy changed this season, particularly race strategy?
Yeah, I think there's been quite a few changes this season. We're only a little bit into it. I think it's continuously evolving as teams learn, drivers learn, etc. I think what we're seeing is that, let's say, the strategy up until race hasn't really changed. What teams and drivers do in qualifying is largely the same, if we think of that as being strategy as well. It's maybe more susceptible to errors because the cars have less downforce, so We see more lockups or more mistakes from an engine management side. So qualifying's maybe a bit more volatile than it used to be. Racing, we're seeing more overtaking than we did in the past in general for each of the tracks that we've been to so far. So that's one aspect, is overtaking's a little bit easier, which tends to allow the faster cars a bit more of a way through than what they had in the past. We're seeing, and that's, you know, down to lots of reasons, the reduced size of the cars, how the battery is deploying, those types of things. We've also got new tyres this year, which lots of the other aspects that were new outside the power unit have sort of gone a bit under the radar because there was so much focus on the power unit. But we've got new tyres, they're smaller than they were before. But that means that when we talk about the tyre compounds in terms of a C1 or a C2, it's not exactly the same as a C1 or a C2 that we had last year. So in general, I would say thus far, the tyres have been harder than they were last year. And that means that we're seeing less tyre degradation. So the tyres are lasting longer into the race than they did last year. And they're more stable throughout the lap. So those things combined are pushing maybe less pit stops that we've seen in the past because the tyres are able to go further into the race. So I think actually the tyres has been the biggest change that we've seen in strategy, which is a bit unrelated to the power unit changes.
A couple of things to pick up on there. Firstly, on tyres, Bernie, if anyone missed it, not too long ago, we were joined by Mario Asola from Pirelli to talk about the changes to tyres this season right here on this feed on F1 Explains. So scroll back on this feed to listen to that if you might have missed it and want to go into more details on the change to the tyres this season. Bernie, one thing you said there that particularly interests me, of course, I'm a Formula One fan, so overtaking is always going to particularly interest me. You're right, Bernie, of course, we've seen so much more of it. Do you think when strategists are in their strategy meetings before the start of races, do you think they are saying, well, actually, we might be more likely to make up places? Of course, track position is always important, but do you think it might promote some bolder strategies as we move through the season, given strategists may say to their drivers, actually, mate, we back you to go and make these places back up because it is proving easier to overtake with this generation of car?
Yeah, I think so. I think when overtaking is a little bit easier, it has a few effects. So it takes away some of the importance of qualifying. Now, last year in 2025, we basically had a series where pretty much the qualifying positions was very, very close to the finishing position. So qualifying had this overriding effect on the end result of the race. So that's a little bit better. It does, like you say, promote the opportunity. And we've not seen it so far yet, but I think we will, where if someone's stuck behind another driver because the pace is too close, they may convert to a two-stop rather than a one-stop because they know that there's a chance of getting back through the traffic. People might be a little bit braver in their pit stop decision, stopping a little bit earlier and not so worried about the traffic they stop into, for example. So there'll be lots of things, as well as that the field, and that's the 22 cars, are at the beginning of this regulation a little bit more spread out. So at the end of last year, when you were looking at who was in your pit window, i.e. who you would do a pit stop and come out behind, the cars were all very close in pace. Now you can look at some much slower cars and know that you're able to overtake them. So it does have quite big effects on when you're thinking of your strategy going into the race, or if you have a slightly slow pit stop, for example, hopefully you might be able to recover that. So I think it will push teams, maybe as we get more into it, to do an alternative strategy in the hope that they can use a fresher tyre to overtake towards the end of the race.
Reminded me slightly there, Bernie, of the Australian Grand Prix. We saw a virtual safety car. I believe it was because Isaac Hadjia broke down around about lap 11. Both Ferraris stayed out rather than pitting under the virtual safety car where they might have got an advantage. Perhaps that's a situation where if that had happened later in the season, where the teams might have had a bit more knowledge of how much easier it is to overtake on these cars, maybe Ferrari would have been tempted to split the strategy and think, for example, okay, Lewis, we'll bring you in the hope that you can battle your way back forward.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a few aspects of that. Is one, you're not thinking about if you get stuck a little bit in traffic, how easy it is to come through. And two, that they weren't expecting that tyre that people fitted for the last bit of the race to last as long as it did. So the two aspects are going together, the how easy overtaking is and how long the tyres are lasted. Now, it's worth saying that we might see later on in the season, Pirelli choose to bring softer tyres. So we might, that one, you know, in my mind, make strategy even more interesting again, because you'll have tyres that won't easily last long distances and you'll have easy overtaking. You should have the tyres dropping off more dramatically, so higher degradation. And all of that would go together to mean that you've got pace differences between the cars that allows quite interesting strategies and races to unfold.
Interesting stuff. We will continue to follow the strategic development of the season as we go on F1 Explains. Bernie, I'm sure it's not the last time you'll be on with us this season, so we'll pick it up with you later in the year. I mentioned the email address, f1explains@f1.com. Do send your questions in. Thank you so much for all the questions we're getting so far this season. Loads and loads of them coming in. We really appreciate it. Marcus is in Melbourne, Australia, speaking of the Australian Grand Prix. I hope you were with us a few weeks ago, Marcus. Marcus says, how does strategy change from track to track? Bernie, so many variables on this one, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a lot of variables. I think, if we think of the first starting point for strategy is what's the quickest race to the end of the race if there was no other cars involved, so totally no one traffic. And the track specific aspects that go into that is what is the pit loss? So how long does it take to do a pit stop? How are the tyres performing? So what are the first lap speed differences between the tyres and lap time? So is a medium half a second quicker than a hard, for example? And then what the tyre degradation is. So how quickly lap one lap the medium gets slower than the hard tyre, for example. So all of those aspects build a very basic race model that says this is the preferred strategy to the end of the race, be that a one-top stop or two-stop, whatever. So they're all circuit-specific. You know, the pit loss, the tyre degradation, that all comes from the circuit. The other thing that then goes into that is how easy it is to overtake. So how much are you going to risk that traffic? You know, if a two-stop is quicker on paper with not considering other cars, but if overtaking is really difficult, you might go to a one-stop, for example, because you don't want to get trapped behind other cars. So the overtaking then affects your sort of race plan more than your optimum fastest strategy. There's lots of other things that goes into that, like the temperatures you're expecting, the wind conditions, they have a big influence on car setup, for example, and what the track roughness is like. So you can get, and you can see it just on normal like street surfaces or pavement surfaces, you know, how much of the little grains can you see or how smooth is it? And that all has a bearing on the tyres, and it all has a bearing on those other bits of the model, like tyre degradation and how we build up that model together.
Track roughness, we'll come back to in a moment. Our next question speaks a little bit about that. I just wanted to pick up on one thing there. Obviously, you as a strategist, Bernie, you're going to be relying on data from previous race weekends. Now, obviously, in this era of Formula One, you might be looking at, let's look at the Japanese Grand Prix from last year, but we're in a very different era of F1. So is data from last year less important than it was before is one question. And my second follow-up to that is we're also going to a completely new track this season in Madrid, where I'm guessing it's even more difficult for strategists like yourself because we've never raced there before.
Yeah, so if I start with the normal track question, so teams, let's say, have done a few races now. So they have some knowledge of how the tyres, the car, the overtaking is performing this year. So what they will do is they will look at Australia, if we take that example, and we'll say, okay, degradation this year, and I'm making these numbers up, so do not quote these numbers. Degradation this year was half of what degradation was last year. So the tyres are lasting twice as long. Really ballpark numbers. And they'll do that for Australia, they'll do that for China, they'll do that for Japan. And then over the course of the season, you get a relationship between this year and last year. You get a relationship in terms of overtaking and in terms of how the tyres are performing. And then you take that relationship and you apply it to the circuit you're currently at. So when you come to Barcelona, for example, you look at Barcelona last year, and you'll say, okay, on average this year, degradation is half. So we'll apply that to the model from last year. Roughly, there's been twice as many overtakes. Okay, we'll apply that to the model of Barcelona last year. So you take your Barcelona data, which is still the most relevant thing that you have for Barcelona, and you will apply the 2026 offsets to it. So that's how you get your base model going into Friday morning in Barcelona. And then obviously any running that you get throughout that event starts to override the information that you've got in the past. So you're sort of interpolating the information between 2026 and the circuit that you're at. And obviously, the further you go through the year, the more data you've built up on this 25 to 26 comparison. So the later races get better and better and better in terms of your accuracy going into it. Because you have some circuits, Australia is a good example. This year it was dry, last year it was wet. So the 2026-25 comparison for Australia is probably not that good. But China, very similar conditions. So you the more data you get as a strategist, an engineer, the better, you know, it just gets better and better. So then when you get to Madrid, you don't have a Madrid model, like you said. You'll have a simulator model and you'll have some estimates of overtaking, of track roughness, of tyre performance. But what you might do then for Madrid, and I don't know which compounds it's going to be in Madrid, but let's say it's C1, C2 and C3, you'll start to look at how that tyre has performed at similar tracks. And what I mean by similar tracks is similar speed corners, similar number of braking zones, all of these things. You'll start to look at tracks through the year. You might look at Baku, a street track, similar type corners. So you'll start to take elements of the tracks you've been to in 2026 and formulate a Madrid model. But it will definitely be the weakest model that you go into on a Friday, which is why we always say at a new track, the Friday running is so, so important. And one of the reasons, for example, last year in China, having not been there for many, many years, having a sprint weekend was really, really difficult. So the learning that you get on Friday in Madrid is really, really important to try, because that model will be less accurate than the others. Hopefully that explains it.
It explains it perfectly. And we should just say, if you're newer to Formula One, the reason why sprint weekends can be particularly difficult, particularly on tracks like China, where there isn't loads of data, is because the teams get less practice time. There is usually three free practice sessions over the course of a weekend. For a sprint weekend, that goes down to one. And then we, of course, have sprint qualifying and the sprint race. And again, if you're slightly new to us, Pirelli has five compounds of tyre, of which it selects three to be that weekend's soft, medium and hard tyre. Those five compounds are named C1, C2, C3, C4 and C5. You can see how they came up with the naming formula. It's very logical. C1 being the hardest and C5 being the softest. Well done to all involved with that. It's an excellent naming system that I hope stays for many years, because if I can understand it, there's a chance other people will too, Bernie Collins. Let's go to Joel. Hi, Joel. Joel says, hello, I listen to this podcast every week. Joel, we appreciate you. Joel says, while watching Free Practice 1 in Suzuka, the commentators were talking about resurfacing the track. I presume they meant the track had been resurfaced as opposed to the commentators had done it themselves. I don't think that'd be Alex Jakes' strong suit, but fine. How does that affect the cars, the strategy and the weekend overall? So yeah, this is the second Japanese Grand Prix in a row, Bernie, where a part of the track has been resurfaced. How does that affect things?
Yeah, so the track has been resurfaced. I think it was like 2/3 of the track this year, I think from turn 7 to the end of the track. And yeah, you're right, Jill, the commentators, we talk about it a lot because it does have a bearing. So there's a few things that will have a bearing on. And some of them will seem very minor, but when you're trying to get in the very detail of strategy, it makes a big difference. So the first one is track roughness. And that is when you look at the track or you look at the asphalt. Sorry, I always say tarmac, which is the wrong word. When you look at the asphalt.
Is it not tarmac?
Tarmac is a brand name. And asphalt is the
right. I didn't know that. It's like when people say, do the hoovering. You shouldn't do that because it's the vacuuming. Yeah, there you go. Who knew? Yes, the asphalt. Brands of asphalt are available, I presume. I don't really know. Carry on.
So just to be, but I always struggle with the word asphalt. So asphalt. So you can see that's made up of tiny little stones, and you can have a look when you're out and about. You'll see some surfaces that are lots of gaps in between the stones. You can clearly see the stones. That'll be quite rough tarmac or asphalt. Then there are some that almost look like perfectly polished, very, very smooth. And the difference of those two surfaces has a massive effect on the tyres, because the very, very smooth surface has a lot of contact patch with the tyres. And the very, very rough surface, because it's got the gaps, has much less contact patch with the surface tyres. So the smooth surface will have a lot more grip. Think of it like sandpaper. So if you've got the very rough sandpaper and you rub that across a tyre, you're taking lots of surface off the tyre. So the rough tarmac, as well as being not as much contact patch will lead to higher degradation. Bahrain is a prime example. Very, very rough tarmac asphalt, very high tire degradation. So that's the first thing we're trying to check is the new asphalt that they've put down, is it rough or smooth? Does it match what they've done before? And that is the biggest contribution by far. The second is how clean or dirty is it? Over the sessions, we talk a lot about track improvement. Track improvement is because we were putting some of our own rubber down on the track, and that has helped to increase the lap times, increase the grip, allow drivers to brake later. So the track improvement is another thing. So how many races have there been before us? How long is it going to get that tarmac up to speed? And then the final, maybe more minor point, is how dark is the tarmac or asphalt? The darkness sets the track temperature. So if you can sometimes see on tracks very dark patches, and in that patch, the tarmac or the asphalt will be a higher temperature. And that affects sort of things like tire surface overheating. So those are the three elements of tarmac that are important.
It always amazes me in Formula One that little things, that it seems little on the surface, like a track resurfacing, can just change everything. And I've been in paddocks for race weekends where a track resurfacing has changed everything, and it's the talk of the weekend. It's, such is the technicalities of the sport. This is a good point to take a little bit of a break. When we come back, and me and Bernie have had a preview of this, when we come back, I think one of the cutest moments in F1 Explains history is on the way. If that doesn't make you stick around, I don't know what will. Back in a second.
This episode is sponsored by Indeed. Building a great team is never easy. If you're a small business, hoping the right people see your job posting isn't the best growth strategy. When the pressure's on and you need the right hire, this is a job for sponsored jobs. Indeed Sponsored Jobs gets you quality candidates when you need them most. Because when you're hiring, you don't just want more applicants, you want the right applicants. Sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. That's because it helps you reach candidates that meet your specific criteria, such as skills, certifications, or location from the word go, boosting your job post in search results so you can reach the people that help your business thrive. So spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all of your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs. This episode is sponsored by Honda. Since its first Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix, Honda has always taken what's learned on the track and used it to build better cars for everyone. From pushing limits in F1 to engineering the next generation of hybrids like the Prelude Hybrid and Civic Sedan Hybrid, Honda proves that racing doesn't just inspire innovation, it drives it. And that idea of taking lessons from the racetrack and applying them to road cars has always been a part of Honda's DNA. Decades of engineering in the demanding world of Formula One have helped shape the performance and efficiency you see in Honda's road cars today. And now that same thinking is shaping the next generation of hybrids as well. Cars like the 2026 Prelude Hybrid and Civic Hybrid show that electrification can be both efficient and genuinely fun to drive. The 2026 Prelude Hybrid and Civic Sedan Hybrid are engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Prelude and Civic and the latest innovations at Honda.com.
Welcome back to F1 Explains. My name is Christian Hugill. I'm with Bernie Collins, the former Formula One strategist, where we're doing some quickfire questions on all things F1. F1 Explains at F1.com is the place to send your emails, your questions. You can send them in the form of just written words. We don't mind the written word on this podcast, But if you would like to hear your voice played to the world, which some people think is a wonderful thing, some people find it absolutely terrifying, but if you're happy to do so, attach a voice note to your email and we will play it and it will go all over the world. That is exactly what this listener has done.
Hi, I'm Jeremiah from New York, and I like listening to F1 Explains. And a question I have is, how expensive is it to race a team in Formula One? Thank you.
I mean, that's one of my favourite voice notes we've ever had, and I'm going to sound really British here, but I love Jeremiah's cute, young New York accent, like a proper little New Yorker. I just think that's adorable.
It was very cute.
Bernie, I'd love you to go through the answer. So yeah, how expensive is it to race a team in Formula One? I'm guessing, Bernie, it's very expensive, but I believe you can help us break down a few of those numbers.
It's very expensive. It's definitely, well, I don't know Jeremiah's background, but it's probably too expensive. But we have...
Joe, I'm just going to listen to this and think, you know what, these numbers are realistic. I might have a go.
Yeah, so the teams have what's called a cost cap, so it limits how much they can spend in a given year on, like, the running of the car, the team members, the equipment, getting everything to the track. And that number, I'm going to read that off to make sure I'm right, is $215 million.
Yeah, which is about £170 million, which is coincidentally how much it costs us to keep producer Chris employed. Don't know if you knew that.
I have been wondering.
Yeah, that's it.
But that doesn't include things like driver salary, the salaries of the highest three paid members. And it also doesn't include things like marketing activities. So when you see, I guess, maybe Red Bull or the best of it running demo cars at, you know, in the middle of maybe New York, wherever they run it. Those types of things are not included in that cost cap. So actually, in reality, the entire team, the marketing, the sponsorship, all of the other aspects that go with it actually costs a lot, lot more than that. We don't have a number on that because some teams that spend more than others, but the $215 million is the what teams are under for each season. To a lot.
Yeah, $215 million, £170 million, or €199 million, according to producer Chris's maths here, which is usually extremely reliable in terms of our conversion. I mean, you know, we're not doing live conversion tables here, but roughly that. And yeah, the cost cap, I remember when it was first suggested, Bernie, you know, being a controversial thing that was suggested, but actually, I think it's sort of been universally welcomed in Formula One nowadays in terms of helping some of the smaller teams on the grid get profitable and stay in profit. But also, and I won't name any names, but there's definitely Bernie eras where you and I were watching the sport when we were younger, where the team that was winning in Formula One was simply the team that was spending the most money. And the cost cap stops that is how you spend your money rather than just having the deepest pockets.
Yeah, I think that is true. I think that there's still obviously an historic, you know, the teams that have spent the most money in the past are still some of the leading teams because it takes time to build it up and get these things. And sometimes teams will invest that money in infrastructure or other bits in the background. So it's still that historic aspect is still there, I think.
And we should also say as well, there's no necessary guarantee that the teams will make the cost cap. And that's where prize money in the Constructors' Championship becomes extremely important. Teams haven't just got that money definitely available to spend. And it's not like it's a case of, oh, it's easy for us to reach that cap. And that's why, for example, you know, Williams coming fifth in the championship last season is huge for a team like Williams compared to coming seventh, eighth or ninth, because the money increases the further you get up the table. Jeremiah, wonderful voice noting. Thank you for listening. We really appreciate it. We're going to stay in the United States of America now and go over to Wade in California. Wade has emailed f1explains@f1.com, and Wade says, after turning the final corner of a hot qualifying lap, why do drivers steer towards the centre of the tracks as they approach the finish line? Why don't they stay along the edge which is a slightly shorter path to the line, it never fails to amaze me the small details that our listeners notice. Excellent detail from Wade. Bernie, what's the answer?
Yeah, so I think it'll very much depend a little bit track to track, but exiting that final corner, I think the priority is the exit out of the final corner. So you, whatever trajectory you sort of come out of, if you think if you're going to do a second lap, then it's important to take the shortest distance that you can to the first corner and make sure that your entire straight is very well done. Whereas the line's obviously always much closer than the first corner. So they just get the exit of the last corner and then try and get to the line as quickly as possible. And the difference in distance is generally very small. It'll be more extreme, the effect that he's talking about, based on where the start-finish line is compared to that final corner. The other thing is, it'll also vary a little bit based on the traffic, particularly behind the driver. So in any given straight, if they can move a little bit off the racing line, so a little bit away from where they would optimally be, it means that the driver potentially starting a lap behind doesn't have any sort of a toe down the main straight. So you don't want to help the driver behind who's starting their lap a little bit faster than they would otherwise have been. So there's a few aspects, I think, going into it. But the overriding one is that you're not so worried about where you're aiming on the straight. You're just worried about getting on power as quickly as you can out of the final corner.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. Wade, great question. Thank you. This next one is for Martha, who is in Ottawa in Canada. Hello, Martha. Martha says, in qualifying, when multiple cars don't set a time, how do they pick the order they get to be on the grid? And when multiple cars have pit lane starts for changing parts, how do they decide the order they get to come out of the pits? Bernie.
So the grid, as we know, is normally set by the lap time that people have set in their relevant qualifying positions. So the top 10 in Q3, for example. If, let's say, two people don't set a lap time in Q1, then there's a number of criteria we start to look at in order to give them their starting position. So it might be, the order is, drivers who tried to start a lap. So drivers who left the garage, did an out lap, and then started, so they crossed the control line and started a time lap. So they're the first group. The second group is drivers who left the garage and at least started their out lap, but didn't get to cross the control line. And then the third group is people who never even left the garage. So they're the three groups that people are put into. So if one driver went out and did a lap and a half, he's ahead of a driver who went out and did half a lap, for example. And within those groups, so let's say two drivers go out and they both start a lap but don't finish it, then the way that it will go is they look to what those drivers set in their last competitive session. So if both of those drivers were in P3, they'll take their lap turns from P3. If one of those drivers wasn't in P3, they'll go back to P2 and so on. So that's how they formulate their positions. Now, if they've not set any lap time at all in the qualifying session, obviously they need to be given permission to start the race. So they need to have proven to the FIA that they are capable of setting a good lap time. So that's one thing to think about. The pit lane start one. So if a driver has some penalties or an issue on the way to the grid or forced to start from pit lane, basically, if they get to the end of the pit lane 5 minutes before the start of the race, or more than 5 minutes before the start of the race, they are forced to line up in the pit lane in their qualifying order. And that uses the same sort of breakdown that I just outlined. So even if they don't have a qualifying order, they'll be given a position. So they go to the pit lane in that order. So if someone qualified P5 and someone qualified P10, in the pit lane, they'll be 1 and 2 respectively. If they don't make it to the pit lane until after 5 minutes before the start of the race, they simply line up in the order that they got there. And so if they both go with 4 minutes to go, they just line up whoever gets there first, basically. And that's to stop us trying to rearrange cars in the pit lane with less than 5 minutes to go. Now, bonus answer. Unless there's a very good reason or there's lots of cars starting from the pit lane, the majority of people remain in their garage right up until the start of the race. So they remain in the garage with their tire blankets on, everything nice and warm, everything under control. And then they go to the end of the pit lane, because it's a bit of an advantage to have your tires that little bit hotter than it would be if you're on the grid. So that's why you tend to see people shooting out of the garage very, very late on, just rolling to the end of the pit lane and then starting the race. So, but if there was 5, 6, 7 cars, you'd see them like a mini grid in the pit lane.
You've given a bonus answer. I'm going to give a bonus answer to a question that Martha didn't even ask, but it reminded me of, I think we've had this on F1 Exposed before, of when drivers set identical qualifying times and how that gets determined. Now, this has happened twice in recent seasons. In the 2025 Spanish Grand Prix, Max Verstappen and George Russell set identical times. They had fun together that weekend, didn't they? In the 2024 Canadian Grand Prix, again, Max and George both recorded identical qualifying times. That one was particularly satisfying because it was a 1 minute 12 dead. But in the 1997 European Grand Prix at Jerez, that is the only time in Formula One history that three drivers have set identical times. Jacques Villeneuve, it says here, Schumacher. Do we think that was Michael Schumacher or Ralph Schumacher? If producer Chris could find out for me, I'd be extremely grateful. A. Schumacher and Heinz Harald Frentzen posted exactly the same time of 1:21.072. And in that circumstance, it is whoever sets the time first gets to take the first grid slot. Producer Chris, do we know whether that was Michael or Ralph Schumacher yet? Because it's of imperative importance before we move on. The breaking news is it was Michael Schumacher. There we are. Thank you, Chris. The breaking news there from the 1990s, from the 1997 season, that it was Michael Schumacher. Had Ralph even started F1 in 1997?
I would say no. Yeah.
No, I don't think he had he? So I got myself into a tears completely needlessly there. What a shame. Anyway, no, producer Chris says, do you want me to check that as well? We know to check that. It's fine. I'm sure Ralph will be happy. Chris says he's got to earn his money that we talked about earlier somehow. Yes, well done, Chris. You've done a fabulous job. Right, Bernie, a final question before we let you go. And this is from Chantelle, who says, hello, everyone. I'm a long-time listener on Spotify, but this is my first time sending in a question. That could be you, by the way. If you've been listening to this podcast for ages or you found us this season, you've never sent in a question, just send one in. F1explains@f1.com. Chantelle says, with Bahrain and Saudi not happening in April, will the FIA and F1 let the teams work more on the car to allow for changes and improvements? Will they let teams actually run a car on track? Bernie, I've been DM'd this question a lot on my Instagram recently. So two questions there, Bernie. Can the team work on the car to allow changes and improvements and upgrades and that sort of thing?
Yeah, 100% they can. So the teams will be working tirelessly in the background through simulator work, through wind tunnel work, through dyno work, for example. And dyno, I mean, it could be an engine on a rig to try and improve that or see where the deficits are on that. It could be a gearbox. It could be the whole chassis sometimes. So there'll be lots of work going on in the background in order to try and improve the car, bring new components, bring new front wings, rear wings, whatever the case may be. That's naturally happening in the background a lot anyway. It's just that this case that the team that you see at the track will also be back at the factory to help with that. So normally in the factory, a lot of that activity is happening. As well as that, the other benefits to the teams that are trying to catch up is they're not trying to repair the broken parts from two races that were missing. So a lot of turnover in factory in terms of producing parts, getting them to track, transporting them to the different places. None of that bit's happening. So you can switch resource from making a new front wing because someone damaged one in China or someone damaged one in Saudi in order to getting the parts that you need for Miami. So that will all help in order to bring it together, and there will be a big effort.
And it's important to say, isn't it, F1 does have mandatory shutdowns in a calendar year, two of them, the summer break and the winter break, where you are not allowed to do any work. And that is to force the teams to have time off, because we know they're workaholics in Formula One. And if they could be working on Christmas Day, they would. Bernie, this is not one of those, is it? This is just, we've obviously in the unfortunate situation where we've not got racing, but people aren't off as such. They are still, I mean, James Vowles has said they'll be using the break to produce new parts, reduce the weight of the car. He wants Alex and Carlos in the simulator. Teams like Williams, you've got work to do. They will be working, won't they?
Yeah, I think a lot of teams will be working, will be seeing this as a really good opportunity to try and catch up. You know some teams have been struggling for parts and they'll be trying to get themselves up to a full resupply of everything. So that would be happening, as well as the upgrades that they want to try and bring. And you just save time in every aspect, because you're now no longer running simulations of Bahrain and Jeddah. You get straight into Miami. You can do lots of pre-event work for Miami. So it will really help the teams that are struggling. And I think that the teams like Mercedes, who have the upper hand at the moment, would actually have preferred to get the two races, get the points from those two races on the board before the teams develop their cars. So yeah, the factories will be full working hours. Hopefully most of the travelling team do get an opportunity for a few long weekends. But yes, it'll be all hands to the pump, as we say, in factories.
I would like to hope there are some long weekends, and I would like to hope there's at least a couple of lie-ins. That's what I would like to hope, but you never know. They're hard taskmasters in Formula One. And then the second part of Chantelle's question was, will the teams be able to run a car on track at all?
Well, I think some people might have seen that there was some wet tyre running in Suzuka. That was a planned wet tyre test, which was always going to happen after Suzuka. Teams can basically have to choose which Pirelli tyre tests they're going to do during the year, and they'll choose it based on what suits them best. So there were some teams involved in that post Suzuka running in order to test intermediate and wet tyres. But aside from that, teams will be able to say, okay, we don't have a race this weekend, so we're going to go and run the car at Silverstone. That won't be allowed to happen. So they won't be able to do a full test somewhere else. What you might see teams doing, and it depends on what they've done before the season, is there's a limited amount of either demo running or promotional film days that they're allowed to do. And they might use some of those days to test some parts, but they are very, very limited in mileage and they're not the correct tyres. So those may be used, but, you know, for example, I could envisage Mercedes using a demo day, 50 kilometres, I think is what a demo day is limited to, in order to give their drivers start practice. So just do start practice. So there's things like that might happen, but it won't be a test day like we see in Bahrain pre-season testing or in Barcelona this year. It'd be very, very limited running.
Yeah, Bernie's done a great job of explaining that there are some elements where there are very limited tests available. As I say, testing tyres for Pirelli, that sort of thing. Other than those very limited exceptions and filming days and that sort of thing, Formula One bans mid-season testing since 2009. That was to, again, help costs, because it's expensive to run test teams, which Formula One used to do. And also help with Formula One's environmental impact as well. So yes, for way more than a decade now, Formula One hasn't done mid-season testing. There is pre-season testing, which is a proper test. But other than that, no, teams are not allowed to go out and do a test day on a track like Silverstone or a test track. That is restricted to pre-season testing only. Bernie, this has been a pleasure. We've covered a lot there, haven't we? We've done strategy, we've done testing, we've done the roughness of circuits. We've got through a veritable smorgasbord of F1 questions there.
Yeah, like you said, we've done quite a lot. And just to echo your point you said about Chantelle being a first-time listener, there are no stupid questions. So just send all the questions and we'll answer them.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's one of the things we've mentioned a few times this season that Bernie, you've been with us since one of our very early episodes, but this is the start of the fourth season of F1 Explains. And it's not just, as we've always said, there's no such thing as a stupid question, but also some of the things our listeners think about that I've been watching F1 since the 90s and have just never thought about. It's like, what a great question. I'd never thought of that. You continue to amaze us with your questions. F1explains@f1.com. Bernie, will you get a little bit of a pause in this period?
Yeah, I've got a few weeks in the UK, so I can get back on the right time zone, which my body is very much looking forward to. So yeah, I've got a little, a little bit of downtime, and then I'm back out in Canada. So that'll be good.
Fantastic. Bernie, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and we'll speak to you later in the season on F1 Explained.
Thank you.
And don't forget to check out F1's other official podcast, Beyond the Grid. Absolutely fantastic to listen to at this period of time, with insights and stories from people up and down the Formula One grid. Of course, there is highlights of all of the season so far over on F1 TV and on this very feed, F1 Nation. And of course, as I say, email your questions, f1explains@f1.com. We're not going anywhere. We have new episodes every Friday. So until next week, we'll see you then. Bye for now.
This episode is sponsored by Honda. Since its first Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix, Honda has always taken what's learned on the track and used it to build better cars for everyone. From pushing limits in F1 to engineering the next generation of hybrids like the Prelude Hybrid and Civic Sedan Hybrid, Honda proves that racing doesn't just inspire innovation, it drives it. And that idea of taking lessons from the racetrack and applying them to road cars has always been a part of Honda's DNA. Decades of engineering in the demanding world of Formula One have helped shape the performance and efficiency you see in Honda's road cars today. And now that same thinking is shaping the next generation of hybrids as well. Cars like the 2026 Prelude Hybrid and Civic Hybrid show that electrification can be both efficient and genuinely fun to drive. The 2026 Prelude Hybrid and Civic Sedan Hybrid are engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Prelude and Civic and the latest innovations at honda.com.